In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. In the past few weeks, Disney, CBS, Viacom, News Corp, GE-owned media sources have reported on how busy hospitals in the New York City area are in handling additional inflow of patients with health complications related to the virus. However, when citizen journalists visit those same hospitals, there are no lines of people, ambulances are parked, it's abnormally quiet, and very few staff are willing to speak. Yes, these are abnormal times, and maybe the patients and clients are hidden from view, but the stark contrast between corporate media reporting and citizen journalists, such as our guest Jason Goodman, warrants further investigation. We're hearing all kinds of numbers regarding those who have passed, and many know it's the obligation of the community to respectfully double-check and verify. Jason Goodman runs the YouTube channel Crowdsource the Truth, and he joins me in the Manhattan studios to give a debriefing of his street reporting from the last few weeks. Jason, welcome to Another News.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
Would you tell listeners about your channel, Crowdsource the Truth?
Sure. You know, it's interesting because I started it about 3 years ago. My background is in Hollywood. I started out as a cinematographer and a director, and I was specialized in stereoscopic 3D for my entire career. And just by chance, in 2009, when James Cameron came out with Avatar, that part of the industry exploded, and I was kind of in the catbird seat, you know? And I bring this up because my approach to cinematography and stereoscopic cinematography and Hollywood in general is very similar to my approach to what I'm doing now, journalism and news and all that. I looked at 3D movies and I said, you know, there's something here, but so many of them look terrible. Everybody was doing it wrong. And I invented camera systems and optical systems that some of which are now industry standards throughout the world for shooting stereoscopic motion pictures. And of course, that industry basically collapsed in 2013. And I lost all my money and had to reinvent myself and come up with a new career. I had a marriage that ended at the time. And not to say that I was depressed, but I had a lot of time on my hands and I was trying to figure out what to do. And the election was coming up and I was reading the news a lot. And social media was really coming on strong at the time.
You were back in New York at this
time?
Yeah,
I came back to New York. My house in L.A., all that, I had to give up. And I just was very troubled by information that friends and colleagues and even people I didn't know were sharing in social media that just was obviously wrong, even within the context of what they were saying. There were mistakes, there were flaws, there were things that couldn't possibly be true. And I was not supportive of Donald Trump for president at this time. I just thought he was a TV guy and a loudmouth and not the right person. And I started looking into some of these claims. A friend of mine posted a thing online, Donald Trump has a rape trial coming up, and he raped a 13-year-old. And I was like, that's shocking. If that's true, I want to know about that. And I started looking into it, and it wasn't a rape trial. It was a civil accusation brought by someone who was under a Jane Doe who had dropped the case, and there were all kinds of problems with the case. But the problems with what the person had posted when I corrected him and said, this isn't a rape trial, this is a civil trial. And they go, well, what's the difference? And I said, look, words matter. They have meaning. And if you're going to accuse somebody of a horrendous crime, you better make sure it's right. And the more I looked into these stories that were coming up about Donald Trump, the more I realized they were either exaggerated or omitting key things or just outright false. And it brought me to Trump's defense. And I started to really like him. And now I am an ardent supporter of Donald Trump. I voted for Donald Trump. I think he's the best president we've had in my entire lifetime. And his recent move to defund the WHO is so strong that if he succeeds in that, defunds the WHO and starts an investigation, if he stops being president tomorrow, that would be one of the best things that any president has ever done. WHO is a corrupt criminal organization. And we're going to talk more about this as we go on. But this was sort of how I got into the whole thing. And it started out as debunking stories in the news that seemed fake.
Well, Donald Trump, has been the target of a lot of attacks. It should be obvious to a lot of people in this country, or worldwide, I would say at this point. No one has seen anything like this before. From the Russiagate to the impeachment, and you have Project Veritas revealing on the inside how the journalists are saying, there's nothing here, there's nothing here. And these are people speaking not knowing that they're being recorded,
right.
and they're speaking in confidence.
Right.
We are seeing, or hearing at the very least, something very honest from insiders, whether it's from somebody on the inside of Google or Facebook or the New York Times, a flat out revealing that there's an agenda.
Yeah. Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, you got to look at who owns these newspapers, right? Jeff Bezos bought The Washington Post in 2012 or 2014 for $250 million at a time when Amazon Web Services had a cloud data contract with the CIA for $600 million. So, I mean, if you've got a client for $600 and a client for $200, which one is servicing which? And, you know, a lot of people were outraged when Jamal Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered in the Saudi Arabian embassy in Istanbul in 2019, I guess. And obviously, I don't condone the murdering and chopping up of people, but Jamal Khashoggi was not a journalist. Jamal Khashoggi was a Mujahideen jihadi. He's pictured in the 1980s with the Mujahideen holding an RPG. And he worked for a news agency that is owned by Al-Waleed bin Talal, who is a member of the Saudi Arabian royal family and who has made no secret of the fact that he objects to Mohammed bin Salman, I think he's 34 now, something like that, the young crown prince who will ascend to king of Saudi Arabia. Al-Waleed wanted that. And it's interesting to note that Al-Waleed bin Talal is business partners with Bill Gates. They own the Four Seasons Hotel, which is also just coincidentally and interesting to know that the top four floors of the Mandalay Bay Hotel in Las Vegas, where allegedly Stephen Paddock used, you know, 20-something guns to shoot up a concert, one guy, 27 guns. I don't know why he needs so many guns. But the top four floors of that Mandalay Bay Hotel are a boutique hotel within a hotel, the Four Seasons.
A lot of people don't realize that, and I just want to make a quick aside reference that Jason, on your channel, Crowdsource the Truth, you are one of few people who have investigated deeply into the Las Vegas massacre. That's not something I really dug into. I was so perplexed in the beginning. We are kind of straying
a
little
bit.
I wanted to focus in on some of your street reporting because I feel like that's something that listeners are interested in terms of getting the truth, what's being reported, the corporate-owned media versus what are people seeing on the street. And there are more demonstrations in this country, such as those in Ohio and Michigan protesting and defying stay-at-home orders. Demonstrators, mostly small business owners, lined up around the Michigan Capitol last week to protest the governor's executive order. 2 weeks ago, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot said the city's hospitals will be overrun, and they currently don't have enough ventilators and masks. Yet, you can see videos of nurses and medical staff from various locations choreographing dances.
Right.
Not only is it inappropriate to be jubilant like this during what we're told is a worldwide pandemic, but if hospitals are overrun, how do they find time and energy
exactly.
to create these highly produced videos? And New York City is considered the epicenter of the pandemic, and the New York Times reported the city death toll recently soaring past 10,000. And there are quotes from hospital staff such as, they're overwhelmed, we've never seen anything like this before, and we're still trying to figure out best practices. Jason Goodman, you were at the Javits Center waiting for the military to begin conversion of the center into a hospital. About how many hospitals have you visited, and would you tell us what kind of information you gathered?
Yeah, well, this is a very good question and multifaceted. So let's first start. You talked about the New York Times and the hospital staff and all that. I want to take a step back for a second because Another one of the sort of topics that I try to cover throughout all my reporting is this technique called social engineering. And it's a word that's unfamiliar to a lot of people. I didn't know anything about it before I got onto YouTube and created Crowdsource the Truth. And I mean, in essence, it's just lying, but it's more than that. Social engineering is, in my view, it describes a complex plan that is designed to cause the target to believe something that is false, and the purpose of it is to cause the target to do something that is against their best interest, like perhaps stay inside your home for a month, close your business, and sit by idly while the economy collapses. That is against our best interests, generally speaking. Now, I'm not advising anyone to defy any orders. In fact, I would advise people to follow the law, follow orders, and do what the law tells them to do. That being said, I believe that there is a massive, probably the largest in human history, social engineering operation that is directly connected to this COVID-19 outbreak. Now, that's not to say that I believe that it is a hoax. That is far too vague, far too general, and a very misleading characterization. I do believe that there is a dangerous and deadly virus. I actually think there's probably more than one strain of virus, but I don't think that it organically evolved or mutated or was transmitted from bats to the fish market in Wuhan, to humans. I don't believe that. I believe that this virus was deliberately set upon the people of the United States, the people of Europe, and even the people of China. And who did it remains unknown at this time, but a lot of evidence is surfacing that has presented a number of, I guess you would call them, people of interest. And I mean, listen, the way an investigation works, as far as I understand it, is unless someone comes forward and gives you a confession and says, hey, here's all the documents, the emails, here's a video of us planning it, unless you have that confession, investigators look at evidence, they use their brains to formulate hypotheses, and they test those hypotheses against the evidence, and as new evidence comes in, a hypothesis is either strengthened or weakened, and at the end of the investigation, the strongest hypothesis that is supported by the best available evidence becomes the conclusion. People can be prosecuted, you can impanel grand juries and things like this, and this might be the first time I've said this publicly here on your show, but I believe I now have been exposed to enough evidence to say, and if any of these parties choose to sue me, they're welcome to, but I believe that Bill Gates is a central figure, if not the central figure, in this crime against humanity. I believe, at very least, he had foreknowledge of this viral outbreak. And as a matter of fact, I think he funded and was directly involved in creating a plan to release this virus on the people of the world in an effort to achieve a number of different objectives, which we see him involved in defending and playing out on television in real time in front of our eyes right now.
It's quite a spectacle when you learn about something like Event 201.
Exactly.
And which was October, I believe,
yes, 2019. That was predicting a pandemic related to COVID-19. Did you know what one of the conclusions of Event 201 was? One of the primary conclusions was that they needed a more realistic and more sophisticated simulation to be able to adequately prepare governments and healthcare workers for a pandemic outbreak. And did you know that the New York Times article, I believe the one that you were referencing at the top of our conversation, about Elmhurst Hospital Center that featured Dr. Colleen Smith, in which she made a big deal about what she described as a dangerous lack of ventilators, which the New York Times video contradicted the moment she said it with an on-screen text element that said, the official word from the hospital denies this, says there was never a time that they were even close to running out of ventilators. Dr. Colleen Smith, in her own LinkedIn profile, her own resume, describes herself as a medical simulation enthusiast, expert. She's given speeches on the topic of simulating ventilators. trauma. I think people who have lost family businesses, people who are losing their jobs, their health insurance, their sense of stability and feeling of safety are being subjected to trauma. And if anything about these stories is not real, is Dr. Colleen Smith simulating trauma on the people of the United States? And if so, she's welcome to sue me as well. I intend to challenge her medical license because I believe that's a violation of her Hippocratic Oath. Jeff, it all comes back to social engineering, right? It's going to sound ridiculous to the audience. This is a conspiracy theory. How could doctors and newspapers and all these things be involved? But it comes down to compartmentalization. There are people who sit on the top of these organizations. And, you know, one of the things that Robert Kennedy said in a recent interview was that he's personal childhood friends with Roger Ailes. They knew each other when they were teenagers. They were like on camping trips in Africa, he said. And Robert Kennedy Jr. wanted to go on Fox News talking about his foundation and their work fighting corruption in the pharmaceutical industry that has led to certain specific vaccines causing injuries in certain specific subsets of the population. We're not talking about anti-vax. We're talking about improperly tested medical products. Roger Ailes flat out told him, I can't have you on because, you know, 70% of our advertising revenue comes from the pharmaceutical industry. That's pretty chilling. So you're not getting news that's relevant to your health and safety. You're getting news that's helpful to the financial interests of whoever is giving you the news.
Pointed out, Bill Gates is directly connected to this as well. And at some point, you thought, I got to go out and verify some of these reports that I'm seeing on the television. Video from news feeds showing lines of people waiting to get into the hospital.
Yeah, I saw that in the news. And again, just like with that story my friend posted on Facebook about Donald Trump, something about it seemed not 100% correct to me, and I just wanted to have a look. So, I mean, I didn't plan to create this whole series Ghost Town NYC and go to all the hospitals that I've been to and everything. I just figured, well, I mean, you know, this would be something interesting to cover on my show. Let me go down to the hospital and see what it looks like. So the first hospital I went to was Presbyterian down, actually right near the jail. This was the hospital they brought Jeffrey Epstein to after he allegedly hung himself in jail. So in retrospect, that's actually kind of interesting because if there is a nexus between the New York Post, who reported the story of Epstein's death, they were the initial ones to report it and produce the photographs, the only photographs of dead Ep on the gurney going in to Presbyterian Hospital and coming out. How did they get those? How did they know he was going there? It seems interesting. Maybe they're great reporters, or maybe, as I allege, they are an operation that's intended to cover up stories that they don't want people to know about, or to present stories in a certain way so that they can socially engineer the world. Because if the New York Post comes out with a story and you're an editor in Norway or Sweden, maybe you don't know that the New York Post is a piece of crap that's barely suitable for lining a birdcage. You think, oh, New York, that's a major city in the United States. Post.
A mockingbird cage.
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt. And for listeners who may not know what Operation Mockingbird is, I'm sure there's very few who listen to your show who don't, but that is an admitted, previously classified operation by the CIA where they infiltrated the mainstream corporate-owned, I like how you called it that, news, and had their people there. Now think about this for a second. Even if, I'm not alleging that everybody on every corporate news show is read into some major CIA plan and they're all conspiring. It's very simple. Someone gets a job at Fox News. Let's say everybody from an intern to Sean Hannity, right? And now in Sean Hannity's case, how much do they pay him? $10 million, $20 million, $5 million, some huge sum. Let's talk about Tucker Carlson, because he was doing some very good coverage of the Las Vegas shooting. He had a video of a helicopter landing in a parking lot during the shooting, and it was like, well, wait a minute, what is this? Mm-hmm. So Tucker goes to Vegas and starts investigating, and somehow that stopped very quickly. He didn't uncover all the things that myself and my guests have. John Cullen has exposed compelling evidence of many helicopters in the air that are unaccounted for on the night of the shooting. But at some point, someone says to Tucker Carlson, hey, you're not covering this story anymore. And we could presume that Tucker Carlson might say something like, well, why not? This is journalism. This is a story. We have to go after it. And they say, Tucker, drop it. And you don't have to say much more than that, because I'm sure Tucker Carlson likes cashing $5 million checks. He likes feeding his children. He probably wants to send them to college and have a house for them and all kinds of stuff. So when you pay somebody that much money and you tell them what to do, they know inherently that if they don't do it, the money's going to be cut off. This is part of the reason why I've created Crowdsource the Truth in the way that I have. There are a scant few people out there who want me to put out all of my videos on YouTube for free. But what I've done is I've created a sponsor exclusive series that's on Patreon and Subscribestar that the viewers actually pay a nominal fee per month. $2 is the minimum to watch every video I've produced. And by doing this, I eliminate corporate sponsorship primarily from YouTube. Most people traditionally have made money by putting videos on YouTube, getting a lot of people to watch them. YouTube attaches ads to it, and then you get money. But this is the same mechanism that is used to control Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Rachel Maddow. Name the journalists. They're all paid.
It's a system of control, and you could be easily compromised. People know this.
Without even knowing it, you could be compromised because they just say, we're not covering this. And look, Del Bigtree, who produced the movie Vaxxed, he ran right up against this. He was a producer for a major CBS show about medical news called Doctors, or I think it was called Doctors. He got a report from a scientist within the CDC that said, the CDC's own data was indicating that the Merck DPT vaccine was creating brain injuries in black male children 18 to 36 months with a very statistically significant increase in that population. And the research indicated that something should be done. Either the vaccine should be changed, it should be administered at a different time. They needed more research to understand why this was happening. And a CDC scientist presented this to Dell. Dell found it to be huge news, which it was, and CBS said, we're not running this. Merck is a major sponsor of the show. So Dell left. He created the movie Vaxxed, and it's loaded with important information. It is not anti-vax. That's what they want, is they want to create this binary situation where it's you're either vax or anti-vax. But the story is much more complicated than that.
We did go astray again, back to Presbyterian Hospital.
Right.
So You
Oh, right. Yeah. So I went there.
Yeah.
And to my surprise, there were a lot of ambulances parked right there in what was obviously the ambulance parking lot. I recognized it from the New York Post photos where Epstein had been brought in. And there were a lot of ambulances, like 7, 8, 9 ambulances. And I just said, well, that's strange. I would think if there's a pandemic along the lines of what I'm reading in the papers that is sufficiently intense that we need to shut down the economy of the world, I would think these ambulances would be driving around, getting sick people, pulling in. You'd have EMTs pulling sick people out of ambulances. They were all just sitting there. No EMTs in them. And an EMT came walking out, and people can see this on the video on Crowdsource the Truth on YouTube. I asked him, is it crazy in there? Is it a pandemic? And the guy was kind of smiling, kind of having a jovial conversation with me. And he said he didn't know because he had been off for the past several days and just got into work. And I said, well, that's strange. I mean, wouldn't they call all the staff in and cancel days off if it was, you know, all hands on deck kind of pandemic? And why would this guy be laughing about a question like that or so lighthearted about a question like that? Why would he even take the time to stop and talk with me? I would think he'd be so pressed for time and so busy that he wouldn't have time. And so I said, well, okay, you know, maybe that's just an anomaly. Maybe I don't know this guy. Maybe he's got a strange personality that he laughs in the face of, you know, mortal danger. So I decided to start checking a few other hospitals. And I went to Mount Sinai and I saw basically a similar thing. Not a lot of activity around the hospital, not masses of people pulling up, not loads of people waiting outside fretting over their relatives who might be dying inside. And I saw a guy. He was an Indian guy standing in front of the hospital well-groomed, had a stethoscope around his neck. I presumed he was a doctor. And I said to him, are you a doctor? And he said, yes. Now, people in the comments on the YouTube videos have proposed that perhaps he was lying or he was an actor or I paid him to be there. I didn't pay him. I don't know if he was lying or an actor. I don't imagine that he would do that. That's a little bit outside the realm of probability. I believe the guy was a doctor. I asked him. He said he was, I think he said he was an intern. People should check the video to make sure. But he was a new doctor, which makes sense. He was a young guy. Said he was working in the clinic. And, you know, what he basically said was that he doesn't know if the hospital is overrun. But according to the governor, what he saw on the news is that the hospital is overrun. And I said, boy, that's interesting that this doctor is seeing on the news that hospitals overrun. So he automatically accepts that they must be overrun. That is social engineering. The doctor is being socially engineered. And then the interesting thing is this article comes out in the New York Times saying that Elmhurst Hospital Center is the epicenter. Now, for people who are listening on the internet, perhaps outside of New York, they don't know. Technically, Queens is part of New York City, but it's not Manhattan. We've got five boroughs here: Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, and Staten Island. And basically, Manhattan is what most people are thinking of when they're thinking of New York City, with the Empire State Building and the World Trade Center and all that. These outer boroughs are, you know, smaller population, smaller neighborhoods, less density, maybe less media there, etc. If you wanted to stage a simulation and tell the New York Times to show up on such and such a day when we're going to have a tent with 1,000 people, it would probably be easier, better, and more low-key to do that in Queens instead of Manhattan. And it's interesting to me that all these people were there lined up outside this tent on the day that the New York Times took their photos and videos and presented it to people with the headline, amazing outbreak, apocalypse, you know, hellish conditions at Elmhurst Hospital. So you see these tents, you see tons of people lined up with masks, and you're like, oh my God, that's terrible. But how did all those people get there? I mean, that's a low-income neighborhood. I walked around, most people didn't speak English. I don't know what their medical insurance status is, but I think even if there's a $50 copay, most people, including myself, would be reluctant to go have an invasive and uncomfortable test and pay 50 bucks for that. Some people might be making 200 bucks a week. They don't want that copay. So did the hospital put out a message saying, hey, the state is paying for you to be tested for COVID-19, come over here and get it? And then when, I mean, if you sent out an email blast to 10,000 people and 600 showed up, and then you took a picture of that with a headline, coronavirus outbreak, people are going to freak out. If you said, hey, New York State offering free testing, hospital has a dramatic response, and everybody's COVID negative. That's a different story that you could put out with the same picture that would evoke a different response from the readers. So I walked around that neighborhood. I walked around that hospital. Same thing. Lot of ambulances there, not going anywhere. And in 30 or 40 minutes, not a single siren was heard. And I spoke to EMTs, one of which who said, I asked them, is there a pandemic here? And he said, well, you know, if you watch the news. And I said, I'm not talking about the news. I'm talking about what have you observed? And again, these guys are having 5-minute conversation with me. They're not there disinfecting an ambulance that just brought in a person with a deadly infectious disease. They're not driving off with the lights blaring to pick up the next person. They're hanging out. Other EMTs I spoke to at Northwell Health on 6th Avenue and 13th, not even actually a hospital, it's an annex that was put there because under Elliot Spitzer, when Andrew Cuomo was the state attorney general, St. Vincent's Hospital closed. So now if you live in the West Village or Chelsea, you have no hospital. It's now condos. So we got the same dopes yelling about not enough hospital capacity who sat by idly 10 years ago when hospitals were closing. And they say, well, we knew there was going to be a pandemic. So what are you doing? And now here's another thing that you were talking about, the Javits Center. So I went by there when they announced that they were going to build a triage hospital there. Mind you, this is right smack at the moment that the pandemic epicenter is happening in Elmhurst, Queens. And it's important for listeners to know that Elmhurst Hospital Center is a public hospital. It's part of the New York City Health and Hospitals system, okay? Presbyterian Hospital, Mount Sinai Hospital, NYU Langone Hospital. These are privately owned hospitals that are not owned by the city. And something that's always struck me as strange, even during this whole Obamacare debate, is the notion of how health insurance works. Obamacare is not saying the government is going to give you health care. It's the government forcing you to buy health insurance. And the thing that's weird is, you know, Jeff, if you and I were driving on the highway and I crashed into your car and we get out and you say, well, can I see your license and your insurance and take down your information? I'm not going to say, oh, Jeff, I'm sorry. My insurance only covers Fords and you're driving a BMW, so you're out of luck. You got to go get crashed into by somebody else. But if you have medical insurance and you go to a doctor, they'll say, we don't take this medical insurance. See, in my mind, a proper Affordable Health Care Act would have included legislation that would have said, if you are legally allowed by the government to be an insurance provider in New York State, you have to meet X, Y, and Z requirements. And if you are a legally licensed doctor in New York State, you must accept insurance to provide medical services to people. And if you are a citizen of the United States who possesses medical insurance, if you break your leg or split your head open or do whatever you might do that causes you to see a doctor, there should be a bill for the services rendered. And if I have a $1 million insurance policy and my medical treatment is $1,000, whatever insurance company I have should pay whatever doctor I go to see $1,000 minus the deductible, which is calculated by very well-known formulas that actuaries use to calculate insurance deductibles and premiums all the time. Why do we have this mix-and-match system where I have to go as a person who maybe is sick and in need and I'm under stress, I now have to figure out what kind of doctor will accept what kind of insurance? And this is causing so much pressure and creating so much waste and inefficiency in the medical system. That is a huge problem. And one of the things that I've learned from talking to all these EMTs is that part of the reason these ambulances are sitting idle is that if there is a concentration of need in Elmhurst, Queens, at a city-run hospital, there is no emergency mechanism in place for privately owned ambulances and city-owned ambulances to intermix. I don't know why Andrew Cuomo didn't say the very first days of this, we're going to take an initial amount of emergency funding from the state or the federal government or whatever, and we've got a pressure point here in Elmhurst, Queens. We're going to move the least infirmed patients out of that hospital first to the closest area hospitals, whether they're city hospitals or privately owned hospitals. We're going to pay their bills. If you have a broken leg, if you have eye surgery, heart surgery, we're moving you out of that hospital to alleviate the staff, to alleviate the pressure. They didn't do any of that.
They did dispatch some other resources, the additional ambulances, correct?
Well, that's ridiculous. They got 250 additional ambulances from FEMA when the FDNY Station 7 Ambulance Depot on 23rd Street and 10th Avenue has had no less than 7 idle ambulances and as many as 11 idle ambulances during the 4 or 5 trips I've made there. I've spoken to EMTs there who, again, they were having sandwiches. I'm not saying these guys shouldn't have lunch, but you're standing around with a sandwich. You're talking to me for 5 minutes. There's 11 ambulances there, not driving around, not coming back to get cleaned, not going away. It just didn't strike me as the type of activity that would surround a pandemic. And we've heard that they're bringing in 250 FEMA ambulances, but every hospital I've been to, there is no ambulance shortage. There is a surplus.
I think this is the kind of information that listeners need to calculate a bigger picture and of what's going on around us. So you were at the Javits Center.
Let me give you another piece about that, because this is important. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what the dollar amount is to retool the Javits Center, which, for people who aren't familiar with it, that's a convention center. That's the largest convention center in New York City. You're normally having your whatever type of, you know, confab you'd have there. And so the governor decided that immediately it needed to be turned into a triage hospital. So how is that done? Well, there's a lot of union work that goes on at the Javits Center. I've observed the carpenters union coming out of the building. Obviously, there's an electricians union. There's probably a janitors union. There's a lot of unions, a security guards union. And all those guys are getting paid to to tool up the Javits Center, but is that the most efficient way to get medical treatment to people quickly, or is that a good way to funnel money to voting blocks that are almost certainly going to be very positive on Mr. Cuomo and likely to vote for him in large numbers for whatever office he chooses to run for next?
That's a really good point. Also, the military was there to build out that hospital at the Javits Center. And I noticed that you were going there. Yes, they were late in getting set up, but it did reveal where's the urgency
right here.
It
would take 13 minutes to drive from one EMT told me it would take 13 minutes to drive. And he said it right away as if he had done it and knew. 13 minutes to drive from Elmhurst, Queens to Presbyterian Hospital in New York. So the question remains for Mr. Cuomo. If there is a pressure point at Elmhurst Hospital, why did I know about it the day after it was announced? And I had a plan. Why don't we get 11 ambulances from 23rd Street, drive them over to Elmhurst and start delivering patients to Mount Sinai, to NYU Langone, and have the city pay the bill? Why is all this money going to FEMA, going to the Javits Center, the unions that build out the Javits Center? How much does it cost the Navy to bring a 1,000-room hospital ship to New York, which, according to a documentary about that ship that I saw, cannot perform open-heart surgery? How do you bring a hospital to New York that is ostensibly intended to address the medical needs of New Yorkers who don't have coronavirus, and it's not capable of addressing the number one health problem in the United States, congestive heart failure? I went to that ship to ask, is this true that you can't do that? And by the way, 2 days in, with 40 patients on there, they brought a coronavirus patient to the boat. And did that contaminate the whole boat? Is the United States Navy incompetent? Are the Marines guarding that boat incompetent? Is FEMA incompetent? Do they not have a system in place to check and double check and verify that people are not coming to this ship with this allegedly incredibly contagious disease? The whole thing has been so mismanaged by the governor, by FEMA, by the mayor. It's shameful.
It seems that a lot of these problems and inconsistencies is also overlooked by the corporate-owned media. Sure, they might.
I don't think it's overlooked, Jeff. I think they're complicit. Let's talk about this article that appeared. Maybe it was first in the New York Post. We should check that. But it went all over the place, and they were talking about Heart Island and the burial of these mass graves, right? So this was another one of these stories that I was like, this is so shocking that I need to know more. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I did was I looked up this Heart Island because I wanted to go there. And I had never heard of it before. I've lived in New York all my life. I was born in the Bronx. I grew up on Long Island. I've lived in New York City for almost 30 years. And I never heard of the place. And I was trying to get there, and it said you cannot get there. There's no subway. There's no ferry. You can't drive there. There's no bridge. The island is used for the mass burial of homeless people, unknown identities, and unclaimed bodies, and has been used for this since, I believe, 1976. The island and access to it are controlled by the Department of Corrections, and the graves are dug by Rikers Island prisoners. And even before anybody ever heard of coronavirus, they bury approximately 2,000 people there per year, which is like 4.5 or 5.5 people per day. So what we saw in those photos was about a week's worth of regular work on that island. Now, again, are there coronavirus victims in there? Maybe. I don't know. But it was at least extremely misleading social engineering campaign by the news. Because if you just say, well, that's fake news, they can debunk you and say it's not fake news. This is actual drone footage of actual people wearing hazmat suits to bury actual dead people. And that is what's happening. But when you get the details of what's really going on
that were not provided.
That were not provided, the story is much different. Now, I also went shortly after that to the largest cemetery in New York. I believe it's the largest cemetery. It's definitely huge. I think it's the largest in New York City. It's called Greenwoods. And the day I went there was a Saturday. It was the Saturday before Easter. And I also called the director of that property, who was kind enough to share information with me. And he said that they were closed that day because it was a union holiday and he would have to pay the grave diggers double time to work that day. Now, again, I would think if, as we're being told, you know, dead bodies are flowing through the streets of New York, somebody would say, look, whatever it costs, we need to keep this place running to stay ahead of this massive onslaught of death. Let's get the gravediggers in there. But that didn't happen. They closed for the union holiday. Obviously, they were also closed for Easter. And the other thing that the director of Greenwood Cemetery told me was that they were, at that moment in time, experiencing about 2.5 times their normal volume. Now, a few days later, I was sent an article from a Norwegian newspaper, a website, from a Norwegian viewer of Crowdsource the Truth, that, you know, translated into English. It was talking about the Deriso Funeral Home in Brooklyn, which is just a few blocks away from the Greenwood Cemetery. Now, I have no reason to suspect that the Deriso Funeral Home and the Deriso family are doing anything other than honest business there, but I went there as well to check it out, because there were things about this article in Norway that were odd to me. They showed the daughter, Sabrina Deriso, who happens to be extremely attractive, and they put her age in the headline, which is irrelevant to the story. It said Sabrina, 24, buries the dead. Now, I've translated it from Norwegian, so it's difficult to make a direct, you know, evaluation of what's being said. But 24 is 24 in Norway, just like it is here. And juxtaposing it next to burying the dead, it causes you to think, oh, 24 dead, that's a lot of dead people.
Gotcha.
So I went to the Deriso Funeral Home, and I was checking it out, and there was not a lot of activity going on there. Again, if this place is so overwhelmed, I would think it was about 5:30. I had to wait a long time for the subway. It took 3 trains to get to Brooklyn, and I waited 20 to 30 minutes in between each one.
I saw that video, and Sabrina did come out.
Well, that was what was interesting, mm-hmm. because the place looked totally closed from the outside. There were not a lot of windows, and the windows that were there were sort of, you know, it's not a storefront that is boldly displaying the items for sale. It's a very low-key kind of business for obvious reasons. And so I was just checking it out. I went around the back to see, are there trucks maybe loading in the back? And then when I came back to the front, as you saw, they opened the door. So obviously someone was aware that I was there. They're either watching my live streams or perhaps have security cameras around their business. And Sabrina and another man answered the door. Sabrina suggested that I come back the following day. And I began to ask a few questions. Sabrina sort of quickly ducked inside. I asked her, you know, she said that they had 74 funerals that they were preparing, which was 4 times their normal rate for that particular period of time. And I asked her why they hadn't listed all those obituaries. When I looked on their website, there were only about 10 obituaries there. And I didn't get this at the moment that I was in conversation with her, but watching my own video back, I realized that she very adeptly shifted the conversation to saying, because the CDC will only allow 10 people into the funeral home at a time. But that wasn't answering my question. I was asking why the webpage, she said it was for the privacy of the families.
That's right. That's what I remember.
But so then why do they ever list obituaries? And why do these families not want their people listed?
The implication there is a stigma of having been sick from the virus.
I don't know. But so she went inside. And then I was speaking to another guy who I had presumed was her father or Mr. Deriso or whatever.
Right.
And that guy was telling me that the hospital had, just during the outbreak of coronavirus, hospitals had changed their policy of how long they were retaining unidentified corpses. He said that normally it was a minimum of 60 days, which I took to mean if someone was found on the street looking like they had showered that morning, wearing normal clothing and a suit, but they just didn't have a wallet and they didn't know who the person was, I would imagine you would presume that maybe this guy got robbed. We don't know who it is. We need to take some time to find the family. Whereas if you recover someone from the subway who is wearing clothing that hasn't been changed for days and days and smells like this person doesn't have access to a toilet and hasn't showered for a month, there's probably a presumption that that's a homeless person who maybe doesn't have family that's going to respond, and maybe that person goes in 60 days, whereas the guy in the suit, they're going to make a little extra effort to try to find the family. What this mortician told me at the Deriso Funeral Home was that the hospital had changed the policy to 14 days, and that they were calling families and pressuring them to come and get their loved ones, which means that they're not unknown. They're telling them that their loved one will be buried on Hart Island, where the people will never be able to go to visit their graves if they don't come and pick them up, while simultaneously restricting the funeral home's access to collect these deceased people and creating yet another news opportunity to have these freezer trucks that are allegedly filling up with dead people. And I asked the guy, well, why do you think the hospital would do that? And obviously, if he's not working for the hospital, he can only speculate. But he made the point of saying that it was promoting fear. And at that point, a taller, quite handsome gentleman who looked like he might be the father of the very beautiful Sabrina DiRiso came and said, no camera, end of interview. I think that might have been Mr. DiRiso. And again, I'm not accusing the DiRiso family of anything untoward. They are a family running a business in an extremely difficult time, and there are a lot of reasons why they don't want to have a conversation with somebody who they don't know that's going out on camera. But I found these circumstances very interesting.
The first guy was very forthcoming.
He was.
And I appreciated that he started to talk with you. And
Did you get a sense, Jeff, that that guy felt like something was going on that didn't make sense and he wasn't sure what it was, but he wanted people to know about it?
Absolutely.
Because I did too.
Mm-hmm. He thought something wasn't right in the hospital policy.
Correct. And city-run hospitals.
Specifically.
Well, I think so. I mean, we're talking about Elmhurst Hospital. He mentioned two others. We'd have to check what those are. But whatever, even if they're private hospitals, it seems that the city is dictating policy. It seems to me that the focus, at least for the New York Times and other mainstream corporate-owned news, has been Elmhurst Hospital Center and this Dr. Colleen Smith, Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, and a doctor by the name of Cameron Kyle Seidel. And the thing that's interesting about these two doctors that is a stark contrast to every other MD who I've spoken to, some of which are members of my immediate family, uncle, cousin, etc., my father, I have a lot of doctors in my family. None of them want to go on the record and go on camera because doctors are always very concerned when they make public statements that people will hear what they say, take action based on what they say, and in the event of a negative outcome, even if there's no leg to stand on because it's happened, can bring lawsuits against these doctors. So doctors are very reluctant to make public statements that are not the official statement of a hospital or a medical association or whatever, because they don't want that liability. So
makes
when
sense.
Doctors like Colleen Smith are running cell phone video cameras in the ICU, and every other MD I speak to is shocked to hear that a doctor would do that, that they say it is definitely against hospital policy. It's a huge concern for doctors with regard to violating HIPAA laws. It's just not the thing that MDs do. So these doctors are doing things. They're starting YouTube channels. They're all over Twitter. And as you pointed out, how do they even have time to do this?
The choreographed dance videos.
Absolutely. This video in the New York Times with Dr. Colleen Smith moving through the ICU is very professionally produced. And as I said, my background is in Hollywood. And I know when you give someone, Dr. Colleen Smith in another video is so technologically unsophisticated that she can't even run a PowerPoint clicker, but yet she's making this beautifully shot video with her cell phone in the ICU. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. It looks to me like a video that's shot by an extremely experienced cinematographer using sophisticated tools to try to make it look like amateur cell phone video. Most interesting thing that happened at Maimonides Hospital when I went there, if you recall, I went around to what was, I guess, the staff entrance, the main entrance, whatever it was, and two people came out wearing blue hospital scrubs. One was an Asian woman, one was an Asian man, and they seemed to be working together, not because of their ethnicity, but the timing that they left, the fact that they're wearing the same clothes, etc. I said to the woman, are you a nurse? She's wearing hospital scrubs and a mask. I said, are you a nurse? And she said, yes. And I said, is it a pandemic in there? Is it apocalyptic? And she outright laughed. So, I mean, that seems strange to me. Her makeup looked fresh. Her hair looked fresh. If you were working a 12, 16, 18-hour shift, wouldn't you be worn out and looking tired and your skin would be oily and your makeup would be not so good and your hair would be, you know, not looking so fresh? And would you laugh if I asked you there was a pandemic going on inside there? The woman laughed and said, ask him. And I asked the Asian man, who turned to me and said, "I don't speak English," which is interesting. What's he doing in hospital scrubs working in a hospital if he doesn't speak English? Maybe if he was working in a hospital in Chinatown, or if he was a Hasidic Jew who didn't speak English, he'd be useful at that hospital. But how do you have a guy working in the hospital who doesn't speak English? I didn't buy it. A viewer pointed out, and this is the essence of Crowdsource the Truth. I can't vet everything. I can't, even if I was the New York Times, they can't vet everything. And this person, this viewer, said, "Hey, look at this picture from the New York Times from a different article. It looks exactly like that guy in a gurney." And that guy was Dr., I forget his first name, but it's Dr. Fan, F-A-N, who was a maxillofacial oral surgeon resident who the New York Times article said he had coronavirus and he thought he was better. He was asymptomatic, but then he started spitting up blood. And this guy was in his 30s or maybe, you know, didn't look older than 40 to me. And I mean, frankly, if you are that age and start spitting up blood, that is a pretty serious symptom that something is wrong. So how 3 days later is this guy exiting the hospital? Why does he look? I mean, if he's throwing up blood 3 days later, he's okay. How do we explain that? That people are dying from it and this guy's leaving the hospital three? It just seems weird to me.
One of the points I thought was important that a viewer of yours mentioned was how non-government people seem to also be deceptive and appear to align with mainstream narrative. That thought occurred to me as well, but it gets into the crisis actor realm. We're into that notion.
Well, this guy might have been that, but crisis actor, it's another one of these things like conspiracy theorist. You know, it sounds very like, you know, anybody who considers themselves in the mainstream, their eyes roll back when you talk about crisis actors and things like that.
But now they do, but back when people were investigating the Boston Marathon bombing and Sandy Hook, not really. Not really. People didn't know what that was.
Well, they didn't know what it was, but I mean, it's one of these buzzwords.
It is now.
Yeah.
I agree.
That I don't know if this guy was or wasn't a crisis actor. He seems to be a doctor. So the question then becomes, well, how could a doctor, someone who is inherently given this position of reverence and trust, how would they be involved in such a damaging deception? It's difficult for people to believe or understand. But, you know, and I'm not equating any of these people to the person I'm about to mention, but people should recall that Joseph Mengele was a medical doctor. So these people are also human and they have ideologies. And what if a doctor is a communist?
You had a guest on, journalist John Martin, to talk about the background of the Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom.
Also a Marxist.
Also a Marxist, a member of the Communist Revolutionary Party, the Tigray Liberation Front.
Yeah.
But he was also the Ethiopian health minister from 2002 to 2012 and the foreign minister from 2012 to 2017 before he became the Director General of WHO. And then protecting the interests of the Tigray Liberation Front, making decisions on policy against the opposition.
Yeah, it's important for people to know that the Tigray are an ethnic minority in Ethiopia. And what the despicable Dr. Tedros Adhanom did, and we should mention that he is a PhD, I believe, in public health.
Microbiology, it said on Wikipedia.
Okay. I don't know if that's correct. I saw somewhere that it was public health administration or community health, something like that. And again, you know what?
Not a medical doctor, not
yes,
a physician.
Yes, yes. Though, whether he's a microbiologist or a public health PhD, these could be suitable qualifications for someone to run the WHO, but it is notable that he's the first person to hold that position who was not a medical doctor. That's interesting. And whenever someone presents themselves as a doctor and doesn't make it clear, particularly when they're talking about viruses and medical concerns, to not make it very clear that they're a PhD and not a medical doctor, that's interesting. So what he did was there was a cholera outbreak happening. And as the health minister, he had the ability to make policy that would then be acted on, just like Governor Cuomo or President Trump say, oh, there's a medical emergency, and that causes the medical examiner's office to build this makeshift morgue. That building of the morgue doesn't happen unless the policy gets made. So certain things happen when they make these policies. What Dr. Tedros did is he said, oh, no, this region of Ethiopia, they're not having a cholera outbreak. They're having acute watery diarrhea syndrome.
He changed the name.
Yes.
Right. He changed the name.
And this denied those people UN funds, medicine,
food.
It caused children to die. It caused many people to die. So this is documented. I'm not making this up. People can look this up. This happened. This is a guy who is in the practice of utilizing his position of influence to create policies for political and financial gain to help him, to help his Marxist party that was supported by and supportive of the former Soviet Union.
Well, Jason, this is certainly a time when more people in this country who might have been on the fence about what they were maybe warned about as conspiracy theory are starting to look deeper into these subjects and find fact-based evidence. And I want to thank you for, at the very least, letting some of the policy and decision makers know that they're being watched. If listeners want to reach you, how would they do so?
The best way to get in touch is to find us online. And, you know, again, you and I were talking about corporate sponsored news, and I don't want this to feel like an advertisement for what is obviously my company and my business, but I am firmly convinced that the only way for an honest news operation to function is for the sponsors to be the consumers of the news, because I don't want to be like Roger Ailes and tell someone important like Robert Kennedy Jr. that even though what you're telling me is factual and something that people want to know, I can't tell you because the financial interests that influence the organization don't want that. By creating a system where it's a micro sponsorship and every viewer is the sponsor, I've eliminated that incredible problem. So if people want to go on to subscribestar.com/crowdsourcethetruth or patreon.com/crowdsourcethetruth, they can sponsor the show for as little as $2 a month. And it helps me continue these investigations and expose the corporate liars that are currently attempting to destroy our country.
Thank you for being on In Other News.
Thank you, Jeff. It's my pleasure to be here.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.